Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Get up again and smile. Get up again and smile.
Good morning and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B is Ms. Janelle Hehe. Good morning, Janelle. How are you?
I'm good. Nice and sunny out. Ready to talk about.
It's going to be absolutely beautiful, I hear, coming up. Temperatures up around 40 degrees within the next week. It's going to be a little heat wave, but you know that's the precursor for the March Madness Slam. When they have the basketball, high school basketball boys tournament here in Minnesota, it snows like crazy. We'd like to welcome our Facebook listeners via Facebook Live, where, you know, we were all told when we were small we had faces for radio, so you get the audio with some nice face graphics in the background. Hope you enjoy that, and we're here today in the news, Janelle. I was just scanning the newspaper, and there's a big piece about Prince again and his heirs, and it's complicating the estate settlement even more because I guess one of them died recently. His half brother Alfred Jackson, who was contesting the will, suddenly died, and Jackson, one of the siblings, heir to at least the Prince left $100 million plus, sold 90% of his Prince estate rights last year to a company called Primary Wave, a well-funded and growing entertainment company, and his sister Tyka Nelson also cut a deal with Primary Wave, getting cash up front. Proceedings drag on. So this is a group of people, what it looks like to me, that just wanted the money. And, you know, we lost Paisley Park to the agency that runs Graceland down in Memphis, Tennessee there. They now operate it, and I've heard rumors and talks of putting a hotel and kind of making that, you know, kind of what they did down there where Elvis Presley's estate was. And that's kind of interesting. I find it strange. Your comments at all, if you have any, about that, Janelle?
Yeah, I also think it's about the money. It's funny because the Prince's book that he published in 2019, it was all about, you know, taking ownership over our what we've created, our musical rights. And now it seems like everything's being sold off, which is the direct opposite of what Prince would have wanted. So, you know, it's unfortunate that his brother just died, and it just seems like the estate is just going in every direction now. Unfortunate.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. We're broadcasting live on Facebook Live, and I'm actually searching for the page because I don't know what page I put it on, but it's there. I'm seeing it right now. Oh, bingo! It just popped up. That's kind of scary when you use this technology and you can't find what you put up there, but it is there. And again, we appreciate you all listening. As most of you know, this past Thursday, the St. Paul members of the St. Paul Teachers Union voted to authorize a strike over lack of progress in the contract negotiations with the state's second largest school district, which is the St. Paul Public Schools. The teachers, St. Paul Federation of Educators, said late Thursday that 2/3 of its members, and that's 82% of the voting members, want a strike. This morning, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about education for black and brown bodies. We're going to talk about what this strike is really about and what's really happening here and why these teachers want to strike. And we're going to be using documents from the union that explain what the teachers really want in this particular strike and the reason why they voted yes to strike, to authorize a strike, I should say, and how this is so far, in my opinion, and of course, you know, you have your own mind, but I hope to persuade you to understand that this strike is not about our scholars in public school K through 12. Joining us today, Janelle, is an educator, a visionary, a forward thinker, someone that's concerned with the education of our black and brown students in the Minnesota as well as around the United States in the K through 12 public schools. Education system is Mr. Marvin Sims. Mr. Sims, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Sims, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? We have a number of folks listening locally. We have some listening in the United States, from as far as California to Miami, Florida, I'm looking at here, New York, Maine, Washington, D.C., North Carolina, South Carolina, Texas, Kansas City, and a few other places. And can you tell these and our listeners locally here who you are, what you're about in education? And then we're going to go right into having a discussion using you as our educational anchor and someone that's concerned about black and brown students. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you for having me again. I'm an educator for over 23 years, but most of all, I want to speak on just being a black man in this system. So just let me give you just maybe a minute or two.
Oh, take your time.
Born and raised in Minnesota from a single mom, three brothers and three sisters. I'm the first in my family to get a four-year college degree. Right now, my two brothers are really struggling right now to make it. One has a high school diploma. The other one is working on his GED right now. My sister is I have three sisters. One passed away when I was young. Mother sister, she's a nurse. And the oldest sister, struggling as well. And I'm saying it vaguely, but what separates me and all of my other siblings is simply a degree and an opportunity. Now, I want to talk about that degree and that opportunity, because how can someone from that family go on and get his degree in sociology, his teaching license in special ed, his master's in special ed, his principal license, and then now I'm working on my doctorate. And I say that, and I have to say it in that way, because I'm an outlier. Because right now, if I had to put a direct read on all of our kids across the country, how well you're going to do, what family were you born into? I just told you mine. How much money does your family make? We were living in poverty, right? And what type of opportunities did you have? Not many. So out of six kids, you see what happens? You get one that makes it out.
Yes.
So if I were going to look at education in Minnesota, or across the country, you're going to have some outliers, but the majority of people do not make it out. So if we're going to have an honest conversation about education across the country, is it a quasi-caste system or is it a true meritocracy? Now, a true meritocracy cannot have predictable outcomes.
Nope.
And I just laid out to you those predictable outcomes.
Yes.
So if we're going to have an honest conversation about what it takes, we have to shine a light on really what are those systems and those structures of inequality that are holding generations back. So I'm going to speak to you as an educator, but I'm also going to speak to you as a black man, but I'm also going to speak to you as somebody whose heart is broken, and I can walk into a first grade, a second or third grade class. I can go to Florida. Put me in an elementary school. Let's open the doors up. I'm going to look around. I'm going to count all the black and brown faces. I can tell you how they're going to turn out. That's sad. It's like that across the country. So when are we going to really have an honest conversation? So hopefully today we can just dip our toe in the water. As a matter of fact, let's jump in. and have an honest conversation about where we go. Because right now, we're getting back what we're putting in. And right now, and I'm scared. I truly am.
I agree 100% with you on that. And what's happening here is devastating to our education system. It's devastating to our youth in the community. But I want to base this on some facts, and I want Janelle and Marvin, I want your response. And looking deeper into the St. Paul Teachers Union and what they're fighting for in contract negotiations, I have to go right to the website, and I have to look, and I find what educators are fighting for in contract negotiations. Educators' top priorities include, number one, a fully staffed mental health team in every building. This includes providing teachers with more training and hiring more social workers, counselors, psychologists, school nurses, and behavior intervention specialists. Number two, more multilingual staff to help our students and family connect with their school and community. And number three, additional educators supporting students with special needs and appropriate assignments for educators so they can give students more one-on-one attention. They say that those are the top demands for the teachers, the educators in St. Paul. Your comments, Janelle or Marvin, on that top new list. What's missing? I mean, that's a rhetorical question, but what does that look like to you? What are they asking for? Anybody jump in.
Can you go through the first one again? I'm sorry.
Let's break them down. Let's deconstruct them one at a time.
Do the first one. Yeah.
The first one, a fully staffed mental health team in every building is the first one.
Okay, can you stop right there? Because that brings me to a Harvard study that simply says a third of urban youth right now suffer from mild to severe PTSD. A third. They're two times more likely to suffer from PTSD than a soldier coming back from combat.
Wow.
When we start talking about the real data, that we're missing that. So how are we going to respond to the needs of our kids if we're looking at the wrong data? So it's not that. So when you talk about being data driven, that's okay, but we're not driven by the right data. So just with that right there, I'd like somebody to speak on that.
Yes, I agree. I actually was in that situation where I had suffered mild symptoms of that because of the neighborhood I grew up in. And I did make it off to college, unlike a lot of my peers, and graduated. But having the mental health counselor in the schools, it just says a lot about a lot of unresolved issues that we don't bring up the correct data in our talking points. Mm-hmm. There's lots of data out there. There's lots of information out there, but I don't think we are presenting the correct information to the public or community leaders to kind of get us on the right path. But the PTSD is a huge thing, and I think a lot of Black youth are going undiagnosed with all kinds of, you know, issues as a result of our, you know, dismantled communities and our families, based on a lot of things that were out of our control and were never, I don't think they ever were intercepted and corrected. And so now today, this is a result of that.
So let's go further down the rabbit hole, which brings me to say, why isn't money one of the educators' top priorities? Why is a fully staffed mental health team in every building a top priority? Let's look at our communities. Let's look at our Black communities. Traveling further down the rabbit hole, we know that the state of Minnesota, especially the Twin Cities, has the second worst achievement gap between white and Black students. They have one of the highest gaps, in housing, wealth, and employment in the country. This is Minnesota we're talking about. This is based off facts. The Pew Institute, D.C., and a couple other think tanks here in the Twin Cities, McKnight and a couple others. And so with that said, would it be a fiscally responsible to correct this disparity? Well, let me put it like this. Say somehow, somewhere, some politician in the government got it right, and they said, okay, these people in these communities need sustainable income, jobs, education, trade, military, whatever, and they pushed community members in these areas to this particular agenda. And in 5 years, you know, you would have single-parent homes like you will always have, but you had working, functional adults, families, et cetera, in schools. What is your opinion? Do you think that needing a fully staffed mental health team in every building would be a necessity, or would that be overkill?
You know what? So right now, we are treating education. When I say education, there's two different worlds going on. I can say the haves and I can say the have-nots. But when we're talking about the current state of education for our kids of color, are we going to treat this like a condition or a crisis? And when you have a crisis, you throw money, time, resources at the issue. When you have a condition, you just let it loll on. You just kick the can. So I want to go back to mental health real quick. And if anyone would look up Columbine High School 2020, they still have counselors in there because they understand how trauma can be passed down from generation to generation. If you look at any public school, I know in Minnesota, I can't go anywhere unless I swipe my license and I got to check in. What was that for? Sandy Hook. When white bodies and white people are affected, it's a crisis.
Yeah.
When black folks are right affected, it's a condition. So how about that? So that's when you talk about money, it goes into the crisis. Let's get some people around the issue. Let's figure this stuff out. As a matter of fact, give me a timetable. When are we going to get this done?
Exactly. And you know, Marvin speaks on something very important, because in the Twin Cities alone from like 19 – we're just going to go maybe 1975 into 2000s, the mid-2000s. The opioid crisis, heroin, prescription, Vicodin, and those type of pills, there was a crisis in the black and Native American community. It was ongoing. But not until the little white kids in Edina and the suburbs around the state started falling dead and overdosing, did the legislature or social service agencies go into this full crisis mode and say, hey, we need to draw attention to this. You can't open a newspaper or read a magazine locally in the Twin Cities without seeing something about the opioid crisis. But why wasn't it a crisis when black and brown people were falling dead of ODs? You know, that's a challenge. Gentlemen, we have a caller. The producers tell us that this is him. M, you're live on the Ron and Don Show with Janelle and Don. Go ahead.
Oh, good morning. Good morning, folks. I've only got a short minute here. I'm on my way down to the Hennepin County Library. There's going to be a Black History presentation by Satu Jones, a noted artist in the Twin Cities area. And he's going to present about his work growing up in South Minneapolis, so I'm looking forward to that. But I called because you know, in talking about education, we go round and round, and all of the factors you're talking about are so true in our schools. I mean, Minneapolis has just fallen down like the abject failure. I mean, that's all I can say about it, from where we were to where we are. But I also had just gotten something on Facebook from my cousin, who's a lawyer, and he's in Chicago. He went to Northwestern Law School. And he always talks about a lady that was his professor named Joyce Hughes. And I know, Don, you know the Hughes family growing up in South Minneapolis. Sally, Joyce, Tony Hughes. But I bring that up for just one reason, and I'm going to go. Because one of the things she said that her father told her, they came up from Alabama, just like my folks did. My mom came up from Birmingham. But what she said, now she's a law professor at Northwestern, and she's still there. I think she must be, boy, she must be close to 80. And she said her dad told her, you can't be what you can't see. Okay? You can't be what you can't see. And so these kids, oh, you ask kids now, what do they want to be? I want to be a rapper. I want to be a basketball player. You know, their horizons are so limited, you know. And when I listened to Joyce talk about how she was the first professor, black professor, at the University of Minnesota, but not only the first black, she was the first woman. And she was the first one at Northwestern, which is a very prestigious law school in Chicago. And the university is prestigious. So I just wanted to throw that out, that if our schools, you know, had role models, like we talked about it down Central, Joyce Jackson, Mr. Bowman, you know, the coaches, the teachers, how they steered everyone, and they were committed to the kids in the neighborhood. And that's what we're missing, in my opinion. And again, that's just an opinion from a layperson in palatial estate somewhere in South Minneapolis. So with that, I'm going to let you go because I've got to run to this program. But and I also just want to throw a few things, just one more thing. I just want to say a if you will and a quote unquote for you know who. I'm out.
And so I'm sorry if you guys couldn't hear me. I apologize. I was just looking at the Minnesota statute 120A for the education code for the state, and I'm a little bit concerned about a fully staffed mental health team in every building. That's just me. But as we move forward, I'm going to go, Mr. Sims, I'm going to read the item number two. More multilingual staff to help our students and families connect to their school and community. What is your comment on that, Mr. Sims or Janelle?
There's a book called Schools That Succeed, written by Karen Chenoweth. Karen Chenoweth also wrote a book called How It's Being Done. And it basically highlights schools getting incredible results, right, in areas that we would never dream of. So she wrote a book called How It's Getting Done, It's Being Done, and her last book is Schools That Succeed. I forgot this was down in Houston, Texas, and it was a school that was 90% free and reduced lunch. 90% EL, and they were their numbers were off the charts. I ended up placing a call to this, I think it's Brownsville Elementary School. I ended up placing a call down there, and I asked them, what are they doing? Every last staff, right, is bilingual. And there's white staff there, but they train them. So they knocked that out, period. Every staff member there. So that's just a little, you know, side note.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about training our staff or meeting that need, then let's get it done.
Well, what do you think the delay has been? I mean, we know we have in less than in under 5 years, the population of students not born in the United States and the population of students born in the United States that are black and brown will be the majority of students in this K-12 system in Minnesota, which means that you will go to a classroom and it will be 99% black and brown or other. What are we doing now to prepare our classrooms and our teachers for this? Is my question. Janelle, are you there still? Marvin?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead. You can answer.
I'm sorry. I got a delay. I got some muffled delay. I'm
here. Oh, I apologize. No. The question was my fault. It's on the switchboard, dude. That's me. My question is, in under 5 years, our classrooms in the Twin Cities will be majority black and brown students. And what are we doing to prepare, you know, our communities, our teachers, our schools for this dramatic shift that's already taken effect in some schools here in the Twin Cities? I mean, what are your opinions? What are your thoughts? Go ahead, please.
I think that the staff needs to be reflective of that, especially in the public schools, St. Paul, Minneapolis public schools. The staff needs to reflect the students culturally. There is a connection that, you know, we will have with our students if there's more, you know, female black teachers or male black teachers, which there's obviously a shortage of in Minnesota. So when I go into my daughter's school, for example, the majority of the kids are, you know, minority students, and then there's a couple of white students, and the teachers are primarily female Caucasian teachers. And so are the principals, male or female Caucasian. So it is a cultural thing where there is some relatability issues that I have to go to mediation next week, for an example, with my daughter and her teacher, because there's issues with that teacher trying to take control of the classroom and the kids not allowing her to, or some sort of that. And I think I'm like, this is not – my daughter's an excellent student, so it's not a question of her – educational level, or she's exceeding all the expectations, but the teacher and her don't seem to see eye to eye, and the teacher's had this issue with several other biracial black or minority kids in the classroom. So there is that implication where in the future, if we're going to have that many minority students, there needs to be a staff reflective of that. And I don't believe in cultural teaching, really. I don't know. The cultural learning thing, that we've tried that already, where they try to put the police officers through cultural teaching, and that doesn't really work either. So I don't know. There has to be more relatability for sure.
Okay. Mr. Sims, your thoughts?
I'm glad you said that, because I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell's podcast on revisionist history. And it was one of his podcasts was called A Period of Adjustment. And they went back and they actually interviewed a woman that was in the landmark decision of the Brown versus Board of Education. Long story short, they did some research about the black schools back then. And then they asked her, what were they like? They said they cared for us. They loved us. They treated us like they were, they were their own. They cared for us. They loved us. And they treated us like they were their own.
Okay.
Right now, that works. But let's go back. They cared for us. They loved us. They treated us like they were their own. When DSEG happened, and all of those, and let's talk about the teaching staff, Brown versus Board of Education, the gavel drops, 80,000 teachers in the South were let go. So then the teaching profession became white, and we've never recovered since then. Let's talk about how our kids. There was no culturally responsive teaching back then. There was no training for the adults to say, here come our babies. We threw our babies in there. So our kids were coming in, right, federal agent walking them to school, rocks being thrown, right? We never clearly recovered from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to put a historical lens on it because we are sitting here and we're acting as if we – matter of fact, let me go back a little bit. And I just say that because anytime I'm in a space and I know some educated people who don't have degrees in my family, grandmothers, grandfathers, very educated but don't have degrees, but have a wealth of wisdom. And so right now I run a mentoring program. Every last kid, we're talking over 200 kids, high school, middle school, they're all on the Be Honor Roll. I got about 25 kids right now mentoring that are in colleges and universities across the country. And if you ask me what did we do, because it wasn't all me, we cared for them, we loved them, we treated them like they were our own. If we start understanding what that means, then we're going to be further off. But I can't tell you how many times I've been in public schools, and I brought that up. We need to love our kids, and I don't know if people understand that. So if we're going to talk about love, I want to talk also about being proximate to the pain. And that's another thing when you're getting into this work is, are you proximate to the pain? So I don't know if anyone has ever gone hungry. I don't know if anyone ever knew someone who's gone hungry, right? I don't know if anyone knew someone, right, who struggled in school. Maybe that might be you. But how proximate are you to the pain? So I say that with my family right now. I know people who are struggling. I mean, for real, for real. So when we're talking about sending our kids onto a conveyor belt of a lifeline, a lifetime of struggle, no, we can't have that, right? Mm-hmm. So, again, let's get back to the foundation of public schools. And it wasn't built for everybody to succeed. It was built for a social hierarchy. We know that. We know that it was built for unequal distributions of resources. We know that. The schools that need the most get the least. And the schools, right, that need the least get the most. This is inequity by design. So when are we going to have some social unrest? When are people going to really take a look at interrupting this massive system? So I want to end this, and I want people to chime in. A system cannot fail kids. It was never designed to protect. Can somebody weigh in on that?
You're absolutely correct, because looking back, you put it in a historical context, and we understand as educators, and Janelle's an educator, she's an author, and all, and we've had this conversation that, you know, how can you learn, like you said, in a construct that was never built for you? Going back to the Emancipation Proclamation, no one ever said that we're going to free the slaves and teach, or the enslaved people, and teach them how to read and write. No one ever said that. We said we're just going to free them. So there were schoolhouses then, but we know that Black people were killed for reading. So there was no desire to even try to go to a book except for the few that snuck and did it. And so today, 2020 and beyond, you have a system, a caste system of folks that in the K-12 system, especially in high school, who aren't interested in reading a book, who aren't interested in reading about their history, who don't know their history. And if you don't know where you come from, if you can't respect that many of the great leaders, let me give you an example. In my school, you know, the go-to folks are Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, who else? I'm going to just leave it right there with them two. When you ask them, well, let's talk about Huey Newton and the Black Panthers doing lunch in Chicago for school kids, breakfast for school kids in the morning in Chicago and other things. when you talk about, like you said, Malcolm Gladwell, bell hooks, Clyde McKay, I mean, all these different black authors, through Baldwin, through the Langston Hughes, through these the Renaissance, Harlem Renaissance, they're so far removed from even bringing that to the students. And that's across Minnesota. And when you, like you said in the very beginning, when you have this system that is not apt on teaching our students, our black and brown students, their history and who died, why they're in these chairs in this school in the first place, you, there's a big, huge missing gap there, which creates a further gap, you know, which gives me more questions than I do answers, because I'm really troubled by it and its uniqueness and non-uniqueness of this design, man-made, as you said, Mr. Sims, like poverty, where you cannot adequately inform folks, you know. And, you know, in Minnesota, we had a, through the 90s, we had the crack cocaine crisis, you know, and a lot of the parents in the, of the kids in the K through 12 system right now are, some are the results of that, you know, babies having babies, that's happened since day one. But you have parents that don't have that foundation. I'm not blaming anything on the parents. They have a hard enough time trying to survive in this system that, in a system that wasn't meant for them in the first place. But sending kids to school has become, to me, in my opinion, has become a sort of daycare rather than a learning opportunity. Your comments, Janelle?
Yeah, I that the daycare thing, I mean, instead of a learning environment, sure, it's just with the St. Paul schools, the $80 million cut or the $80 million setback in budget, I don't understand, like, is that primarily for wages? Because I think you're a little bit more informed on that than I am. I'm just curious.
Yeah, when they take, when kids go to different school districts, when parents go, I'm fed up, and they take their black, brown, yellow, red, black, or white kids or whatever, and they put them in Woodbury, Minneapolis, Edina. They take them out of the school district. The district loses a substantial amount of dollars.
Okay.
And resources. It's not necessarily across the board teacher salary, because they don't pay the teachers enough. Like if they paid the teachers between $80,000 and $100,000 a year, there would be no need for a union.
Okay. And that's why in the article in the Star Tribune, it did highlight that the enrollment is down, and that's why the funding is in direct correlation with that, and that is also down. So the people are going to different districts to try to get a better education, quote unquote, a better education. Interesting. I don't understand how we're just redistributing everything back out of our communities again. It's just like a vicious cycle.
Yeah, it is. And the day, there's data, as Mr. Sims was talking about earlier, there's data that shows that a black or brown child who transfers from an inner city school to go to a suburban school really does not do any better.
Interesting.
I mean, his friends might be different, the surroundings might be different, the academics might be different, but generally that person is who that person is in 10th, 11th, or 12th grade.
My sister just transferred her kids over to Eden Prairie from Bloomington, Bloomington District, because of the violence in the schools or what, and I don't know. But the kids, they can't relate to the kids in Eden Prairie. They just can't relate to the kids in that community. It's very difficult. My daughter went to a suburban school and she hated it, and now she's in a Minneapolis school and she likes it a lot more. It's just the culture and the environment is a lot easier for her to learn. She's actually doing a lot better. So I don't understand either how that's going to solve anything. And the data obviously shows that it's not really benefiting them educationally. So are we going to, how long is that? How long are we going to keep busing our kids out of our communities? And why is it so difficult for us to always get the funding that we need to improve our own schools? I don't.
Yeah. It's rough. It's rough. When I just saw this thing about the wealth distributed in the Somali community in Minneapolis,
mm-hmm.
Minnesota, and I was like, wow. you know, that's really different from the Black American wealth distribution from local city, state, and county agencies. And it looks like a huge disparity right there. And I'm saying, I wonder if the Black community received those same benefits, would we be in the same situation? I'm not saying the government has ever solved the problem in the Black community in Minnesota. I'm not saying that because they have not. But I'm saying, wonder if it was a fair and balanced distribution of wealth. Wonder if they decided that, okay, we're gonna make sure that everything is equal or near equal, so we don't have to wait till the year 2081, and that everything is going to work for the benefit of our students, because we're having some. Marvin, Mr. Sim said earlier, it's a crisis, and in this crisis, you don't have a lot of winners. And in Chinese, don't even have a word for crisis; they call it opportunity. So what again, our call-in number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. Our phone lines are open if you have a comment or concern or suggestion about any topic you'd like to talk to. Right now, we're on live with the air with myself, Janelle, and educator Mr. Marvin Sims on the Ron and Doctor on Blog Talk Radio. We'd like to thank you for those that are listening via Facebook Live. The time is 10:13. And again, you're listening to the Ron and Don Show with Janelle Heavey and Don Allen on Blog Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. And Marvin, this third piece for this contract negotiation for the educators, additional educators supporting students with special needs and appropriate assignments for educators so they can give students more one-on-one attention. What do you think about that?
By law, IDEA, you have to do it.
Yeah.
Right? So I understand that. Also, putting kids in the least restrictive environment, I understand that too. You talk about opportunity. This might be the generation that, I mean, for us to get education right. So I think when you talk about where we go from here, I don't know if it was in last year's Star and Tribune front page, September, $300-something million. Funneled into Minnesota schools, and the gap still exists.
Yeah.
Right? So it's not about the money. I want to give a shout out to Capital Prep out in Hartford, Connecticut. 100% of that, those kids in that school go on to universities. I want to give a shout out to Urban Prep in Chicago. 100% Black. All those kids go on to universities. I want to give a shout out to Eagle Prep. This is in the Bronx. All those kids are going to universities. But I personally want to give some love to Medgar Evers College Preparatory, which I went and visited in Crown Heights, Brooklyn.
Mm.
100% Black, 100% free and reduced. This is the only school that I know. When you come to graduation, every kid's name's in the manual, but right next to that is a college that they're going to, special ed included. Special ed included.
Wow.
So I saw it with my own eyes, and I asked the kids, what are you guys doing over here? What's so special? They looked at me like I was crazy because they didn't know what I was talking about, because they were in an environment that just said, you can do it. You can. We believe in you. We love you. They asked me what I did in Minnesota. I said, I'm an equity coordinator. They said, what is that? I couldn't even tell them. If you came over to our side, half of y'all won't make it. I couldn't tell them that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we start talking about what's right for kids, I'm just going to say this. This might solve some of this. If we put the needs of kids first and the needs of adults last, we might be getting somewhere.
I would have to agree with that. Let me put this on the table. Is there a need in the Twin Cities for an all-black school based on the successes around the country from Jeffrey Canada and the Bronx, New York, schools in Chicago, from the schools out in California, Denver, Houston, and the state of Florida, which each of those states or areas have schools with all black and brown students, and their graduation rates are at 100% and their college acceptances are at 100%. Is that something that we need to do in the Twin Cities? Anyone?
I'm going to chime in. I'm talking too much. But I just want to say this point. If right now we're suffering from an educational cancer, and cancer affects everybody. If I knew the solution for cancer was in a community that maybe most people don't want to even get caught, they don't want to go there. I don't care what it looks like. Right, and as a black man, if the cure for cancer was in someone who didn't like black folks, we call them a racist. I don't care. I need the cure. Right, the cure that we're looking for, people have solved it. I just gave you five schools, but when have people had cultural humility to say, what are they doing? Hey, I got black folks in Chicago, and we got black folks in Minnesota. Give me your syllabus. It's not that. What I didn't mention what I saw at Medgar Evers College Preparatory. I walked in there. The first thing I saw was a bust of Medgar Evers. You can kill a man, but you can't kill his dream. I suddenly felt at home, and I'd never been to that school. I walked in and I took a hard left. There was a picture of a 1950s schoolhouse, and it says you must know from whence you came, right, to know where you're going. And then right next to that, it was a drinking fountain, or two students drinking out of water, out of a fountain, and one said white, another one said colored. But then right next to that was this huge bulletin of AP honors, all the kids, and it was just tons of them. So I started getting this feeling like, man, they're about something. And then this young lady walked in, and she probably was a sophomore. She walked in late with an attitude, shaking her head. The hall monitor walked in and said, you're late to class, what's going on? The young lady gave her attitude. This hall monitor checked this young lady like my mother would check me. Then she gave her a hug and said, baby, I need you to get to class. That girl dropped her attitude. She went to class. If she was in any school in Minnesota and she walked in late giving the hall monitor some attitude, no, you're going to the office. No, we're going to kick you out. It wasn't done with – it was disciplined with love. Then I'm sitting here waiting to talk with the principal to get kind of what's going on here. One of their kids comes down sagging his pants. There happened to be another gentleman from Canada doing the same thing I was doing, researching the school. The principal secretary looks at this kid and said, boy, you know better. Pull your pants up. We're better than that around here. He looked at her. He said, yes, man, pulled his pants up. She said, now get in there and tell them what we're about. Again, I've seen kids brought down to the office, shamed because their pants were low. But she said, hey, we're better than that. Pull your pants up, boy. Show them what we're about. She did it with love.
Mm-hmm.
I gave those two examples because right now we have overrepresentation of blacks being referred to suspension and kicked out of school. And if you peel back to what's really going on, do you know what the problem was? It was respect.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at respect, all our brothers and sisters want, just see me. See me. Respect is, but you got to see me first. And what I saw was two examples of
of people treating these students with care, love, and respect. Let me put a little discipline on it. But that's what needs to happen. But there's a lot of other things that go into this. But again, we talk about color and just being isolated to one race. Do we need to do this? It comes down to, again, like I said before, you got to, love doesn't have a color, right? Treat you like my own doesn't have, right? But here's why I got to go there. How does race play a factor? How does race play a factor right now? Because if the Star Tribune put out an article tomorrow and it said Minnesota has not only closed the achievement gap, the African-American students are outperforming the white students. How long would that last? That's going to answer your question.
Yeah, that's going to be deep. How long before that is Shanghai? And it's interesting that you said that. I want to play this little piece, this clip, while you were talking. I just went ahead and uploaded it real quick so we could hear this again. Some WCCO, if I'm not mistaken, here, and talks about the state of Minnesota and where we're at as people. And I just want to play this real quick.
A new report lists Minnesota among the worst states in America for racial inequality. The website 24/7 Wall Street listed Minnesota as the second most unequal state in the country behind Wisconsin. It measured gaps between blacks and white residents in areas like unemployment, income, and home ownership. New at 10, WCCO's Jeff Wagner learned what the numbers mean and how organizations are trying to bring balance to Minnesota.
Racial inequality is no secret in the United States. Earlier this month, the tension connected to it ignited in the streets of Charlottesville, Virginia.
We look at Charlottesville, and we look at the tiki torches burning there, but people don't realize we're being scorched every day here in America, especially here in Minnesota.
Minneapolis NAACP President Jason Soule feels his point is validated thanks to a recent study by 24/7 Wall Street, which labeled Minnesota as the second most racially unequal state in the country, right behind Wisconsin and just ahead of South Dakota, Illinois, and Iowa.
I'm from Chicago. I graduated in Waterloo, Iowa. I've been living in Minnesota the last 17 years. Every place I've lived, I felt this immense pressure.
The study found that black people in Minnesota are 10 times more likely to end up in jail or prison than white people. It also found the median income for a black household is just over $30,000, but a white household is double that number. Race relations experts feel those two statistics are directly connected.
If you do have employment, it pays a very low wage. You are a renter at best. And then if you are thoroughly outside of the labor market and participating in the underground economy, then you may end up in jail.
Soule says fixing the issues starts by holding government entities and law enforcement accountable. Mobilizing is the next step.
Use that report and analyze it critically. Let's talk about it with our families. What do these numbers represent?
That study also found that black people in Minnesota have a home ownership rate of 21%, but the number for white people was more than triple at 76%.
And Jeff, how about Minnesota's education system? How will that play into this?
You know, that's where we have that achievement gap that people know about in this state. The latest numbers from the Minnesota Department of Education found that in grades 3 through 8 and also 10th, the amount of white students who met the standard for reading and math was about double that of black students. So these disparities clearly are beginning at a young age.
All right, Jeff, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is, that last part. Marvin and Janelle, you have it in a nutshell. It seems to me to fix education, you're going to have to fix a lot of other things too. So where do we start? Say if education is fixed. Say that in 2 years, black students, or less than 2 years, black students are outperforming their white counterparts in the classroom, and there becomes a white achievement gap. What happens? What will be the difference?
A white achievement gap? That sounds like a fantastical idea. I don't know. I think they would take very aggressive measures to fix that gap, and they would be a lot more empathetic and there would be a lot more money going towards that program. Not only money, but just a lot of different resources and efforts to close the gap.
just like with the drugs, the opioid crisis versus the crack cocaine epidemic. It's just they look at it in two separate things. It's not the same thing. And there's no way, like when he was talking about how they can they should be able to relate to us, like when he gave those great stories, examples of relatability and showing love with discipline. I think that some people are just incapable of doing that. Incapable. So I think that if we have our own in our schools, then it's just going to be better relatability, and there's going to be that love with discipline, because it's a feeling of, you know where I'm coming from. You know where I'm coming from. We're coming from the same place.
Exactly. And with that said, so Marvin, Mr. Sims, would you like to get in some few words here before we close out with 2 minutes left of the show?
The core of our educational system is flawed at the foundation, the core. And we have testing, and we have to build our kids' characters up. We have testing, and our kids are not eating. We have testing, our kids don't feel good about who they are. We have testing, and our kids are not prepared to leave us when they graduate. So we don't fundamentally change the foundation of our schools. What we're going to get is a catastrophic situation in which we're all going to pay. So we either pay for it now or we pay for it later. I don't want to pay for it later.
Thank you. And with that said, I'd like to thank you, Janelle Hehe, and for being co-host again on the Ron and Don Show. And we'd like to thank our special guest, Mr. Marvin Sims, Minnesota educator, who will stay the whole show and was live with us. We appreciate it. You've been listening to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio. And as usual, in the tradition of the late Mr. Ronald A. Edwards, we'll let James Brown take us on home. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.